Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Prognosis. I'm Laura Carlson. It's day 237 since coronavirus was declared a global pandemic. Today's main story: the risk of COVID-19 transmission is high on college campuses, where students live in close quarters and may avoid following social distancing rules. But one upstate New York university has stayed open and managed to control its COVID cases. But first, here's what happened in virus news today. Infections in the U.S. increased by 1.3% on Friday, with Iowa, North Dakota, Michigan, and Colorado seeing the biggest single-day rises. That's according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg News. Yesterday, new cases passed 126,000. A global record for a single nation. Johnson & Johnson is about to start clinical trials of its COVID-19 vaccine in South Africa after getting regulatory approval, according to the co-chair of the study in the country. Meanwhile, scientists monitoring wastewater in one region of the country detected spikes of the coronavirus in the last 3 weeks. The government is concerned that a lack of compliance with health guidelines may trigger a second wave. Finally, France posted a record number of new virus cases as the nation's health minister, Olivier Véran, warned that a violent second wave of the illness is sweeping the country. He said virus patients now occupy more than 85% of French hospitals' initial intensive care facilities. Europe is battling a new surge in the virus, with France starting a second lockdown just last week.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel has become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
And now for today's main story. Cornell University in upstate New York welcomed around 24,000 people back to campus this fall. The idea of students packed into dorms and mingling in classrooms made many people nervous. But while outbreaks have plagued colleges across the country, Cornell has managed to keep a lid on its COVID cases. In fact, the college's test positivity rate has been among the lowest of any college or university in the country doing large-scale testing. I spoke with reporter Emma Court, an alumna of Cornell, about how the school has done it. You know, the story with so many colleges and universities around the U.S. for the fall term has either been one of online or distance learning. And many of the stories we even have heard about students on campus has been pretty negative news with outbreaks and the spread of COVID. But not Cornell. And I was wondering if you might just unpack what happened at Cornell to make it this success story.
Yeah, so I would note Cornell isn't the only school that has been able to keep cases very low, but it's what's significant is what a big school it is. Cornell reopened its campus to about 24,000 people in the late summer. And really what they did was kind of take all the public health measures that are recommended. And in fact, they say that their experience is a testament to the fact that the things that we've been talking about throughout this whole pandemic, from, you know, frequent testing all the way to mask wearing and hand washing, that they work. Most significant about what Cornell did, I would say, is that frequent testing. They're testing about 35,000 students, faculty, and staff a week. Undergrads are tested as frequently as twice a week. They say that has helped them find these people who could be, you know, asymptomatic silent spreaders of the virus and really tamp down on that spread and, you know, isolate people and prevent further infections on campus. Another thing that they really cite for their success has been sort of a souped up version of contact tracing. They do something called that they call adaptive testing, which is instead of sort of adhering to the strict definition of a contact, you know, there are different definitions for contact tracing. But in New York State, it's someone who's been within 6 feet of someone who had a confirmed COVID-19 infection for about 10 minutes. So they did something a little bit more expansive. They did do contact tracing, but they also did this thing where they looked at people who might have been exposed but weren't technically close contact. So if you're living on a dorm floor and you turn out to have COVID-19, they might test everyone on that floor because you're all sharing a bathroom. If you're on a hockey team, maybe you weren't technically within 6 feet of someone for 10 minutes, but you know, you're likely spending time around them and maybe you could be infected. So maybe you test the whole hockey team. So they say this is something that kind of goes above and beyond the call of duty and, you know, help them basically lock down the chains of transmission on campus.
I was wondering if you might go into just actually how low the infection rate has been on campus. And I mean, among those few infections that Cornell has seen, where are we seeing transmission coming from? Is this something that students are being exposed in the classroom or is it coming really from somewhere else?
Just to start off with, I just pulled up Cornell's COVID dashboard, and right now their positivity rate is 0.04%. So, you know, 0.04% of their tests return positive. That's really good. And in a recent week, a couple of weeks ago, it was actually as low as 0.006%. So they were joking that they would have to add another, you know, decimal place to the online dashboard. It was so low. You know, if you look at how many cases they've had since they reopened, it's been about 171 cases from mid-August to basically now, through November 4th. That's really significant because that is very low. And they do have a lot of people, you know, 24,000 people on campus. You know, things didn't look like they were going to go quite this way when I first started my reporting, though. You know, I talked to a lot of people in August before campus reopened, and the plan was constantly changing. There was a lot of anxiety among people in the community, you know, students, their parents, faculty members, because it looked like a big risk that Cornell was taking. They were bringing all these people to upstate New York, you know, at the time had been very much untouched by COVID-19. It was very, you know, rates were very low. And so it seemed like things could go pretty awry. And in fact, you know, as students were coming back to campus, there was an early cluster of cases on campus that really raised a lot of alarm bells, you know, which was actually tied to student athletes socializing without the proper, you know, social distancing and mask wearing. But, you know, Cornell, again, really credits this aggressive testing and contact tracing to helping kind of stem that chain of transmission. And in fact, you know, they did a lot of interesting modeling around how infection could spread around campus, really plotting out a lot of different scenarios. That's actually how they ended up doing so much testing. They realized they needed to in order to keep infection low. And they set out a couple of different scenarios for how, you know, infections could spread. And the actual cases on campus have actually stayed so low that they've been far lower than even the most optimistic scenario, which I think is really a testament to what they've done.
And, you know, you've mentioned a lot of this plan and perhaps their success does revolve around the amount of testing that's going on. And that's quite a significant amount of testing. I was just curious, how is the university handling this amount of regular testing?
Cornell actually set up a new lab in its veterinary school to do human testing. Interestingly, a number of colleges and universities have actually done this because this mode of, you know, the common mode of COVID-19 testing is something called polymerase chain reaction tests, and they're actually often used to look for disease in animals. The big thing that they did, and other colleges have done this too, is that they did something called pooling, where you put multiple samples together and process them at the same time. This is something that works actually best when you don't have a lot of infection on campus, as Cornell has. You know, it's important to note that this has been a big push for Cornell, and they're running their lab, you know, practically 24/7. And it's been difficult. You know, they set up all these centers around campus for people to get their samples collected. You know, it's a nasal swab. And it's something that, you know, took up a lot of their resources, but also, you know, a lot of participation from the community to go in and get tested so frequently.
And you've raised a really important point, I think, that many other colleges and universities might be looking to Cornell's policy because, I mean, in all honesty, Cornell has been able to welcome students back. They've been able to collect, particularly from the financial angle, room and board rents from the students that are back on campus. Is this something that perhaps other college campuses, other universities can look to Cornell as perhaps a model for how they can apply this policy on their own campuses?
You know, a lot of cynics and skeptics when colleges said that they were going to reopen pointed to the fact that colleges had a real financial incentive to reopen. You know, it's hard to justify charging a lot of tuition when your students are basically, you know, at home living with their parents, you know, taking classes online. I think for Cornell, what's important to note is that they did have advantages, and they acknowledge those advantages, you know, from the fact that Ithaca is a pretty remote location. Ithaca, when you're driving up, is really a lot of cows and fields. So, you know, that's an advantage because you don't have a lot of people coming and going from other places where they can bring the virus, although Cornell has had people bring the virus that way to campus, and they've found it using that testing. And there are other advantages just conferred by their, you know, financial and scientific resources that are important to note. And again, might be hard for other schools to replicate, particularly if they don't, you know, have these kinds of resources.
And I mean, here we are. It's early November, but the end of the fall semester is in sight. Students are about to leave to go on holiday, to go back to their family and friends all over the U.S. and the world. Is this going to affect Cornell's plan for the spring? Or is this fall scenario what Cornell is expecting to adopt in the spring?
Yeah, Cornell is planning a spring semester, you know, in person. You know, they're hoping to bring even more students back this time, hoping to do more classes in person. And they have a lot more time to plan now than they did last time. A lot of things were really quickly changing right before the semester began, including, you know, a lot of students were coming from states that had been put on New York State's quarantine list. And so that made it very difficult logistically for everyone to come back. I think it's important to think about also how things will be different in the spring semester. You know, they're planning on starting classes in February. You know, the weather in February in Ithaca can be quite cold. And as we all know, winter could be a real time of spreading COVID because of those cold temperatures, bringing people together inside more where they could, you know, are more likely also to spread the virus. So, you know, it's going to bring a new slate of challenges for Cornell. And in fact, right now, the university is already seeing infection rates in surrounding communities on the rise. And so it kind of went from the situation where the community was worried about Cornell bringing COVID to their backyards. And now Cornell is starting to warily look at the community and say, maybe people are going to get sick, you know, in our surrounding areas. And they've started to see some of that already.
That was Emma Court. And that's it for our show today. For coverage of the outbreak from 120 bureaus around the world, visit Bloomberg.com/coronavirus. And if you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It's the best way to help more listeners find our global reporting. The Prognosis Daily Edition is produced by Topher Forges, Jordan Gaspure, Magnus Henriksen, and me, Laura Carlson. Today's main story was reported by Emma Court. Original music by Leo Sidrin. Our editors are Rick Schein and Francesca Levy. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. Thanks for listening.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.